Welcome, folks, to episode 3673 of the Survival Podcast. Today is Monday, May the 19th, 2025, and today's episode title is Our Top 5 Economic Challenges. Now, if I would have given it a title that really explained it fully, it would have been way too long. We're going to talk about exactly what we just said, our top 5 economic challenges to really recovering the United States economy. Like, all this talk that Trump has about reshoring manufacturing and using tariffs to leverage better trade deals, how to handle inflation, how to deal with the monetary supply, all these things. Like, here's what's actually wrong, okay? And then what are the problems at two different levels we're going to look at? What are the problems from a federal management level? I think a lot of people don't realize how many things in your life are screwed up because of your state, small s, rather than the state, big s. In other words, you know, you live in Alabama, it's an Alabama problem or a Birmingham problem. It's not necessarily a Washington, D.C. problem. Both contribute. But one thing we do have to be honest about is if the federal government's making a problem and the federal government does something to mitigate that problem, probably not solve it, mitigate it, okay, that takes place across all 50 states, but if the state of Alabama or the state of Georgia or the state of California or Washington or Oregon, Illinois is doing something to cause a problem and the Fed makes a change, unless there's some sort of mandate that's enforceable with it, it doesn't change that problem, does it? Yeah. So we're going to look at the problems from the federal and the state level, and then we're going to look at solutions, like what could be done from a central management standpoint, just three bullets on each one of those that would combine federal and state solutions. And then since, well, that's probably not going to happen, or even if it does, it won't be sufficient, or there'll be some other aggravating thing that prevents it from actually doing what you need it to do, what can you do? And that's the real issue that we're covering today. I started this show out, and I started researching and developing a list of the top 10 economic problems that the country has. And when I realized if we're going to actually not just bitch about it at the surface level and actually dig into it, that's not going to work. So there might be a second episode of the show in like a series. But as of right now, it is standalone, because I think if we can get our head around these five and what we can do about them, then we're in pretty good shape for the other five. But we might do that just for educational and entertainment purposes, because I know you guys do like a lot of the gloom and the doom. So we'll be bringing both the gloom and the doom and the hope and the inspiration and the motivation today, I hope. With that, before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is Start9 Private Servers. You have a choice right now, basically. You can have sovereignty over your data, sovereignty over access to your data, sovereignty over your communications with other people, and sovereignty of your money through things like Bitcoin by running your own node, or you can let other people do it for you. And you can trust that those other people will do it with your best interest in mind, and they probably won't. But all that goes away once you get a little box from a company called Start9 and configure it to do all of those things. There's a little bit of a learning curve, but it's not that big of a deal. You will be able to figure it out. I will simply ask you this. Can you install apps on a phone and configure and use the apps that you install on your phone? If you can do that, you can figure out everything with Start9. I would say the hardest thing to do with Start9 of all the things you can do is to run a Lightning node. And I'll preface that with, but you may not need to. You might want to, but you may not need to. But the issues with doing that are nothing to do with Start9. They're about understanding Lightning and know how to balance liquidity. All the other stuff is really easy to do, and actually a bigger reason to get a Start9 box than running a Lightning node, because there's a lot of other options for handling that need. But check them out today, and remember, you can get 9% off everything at Start9 if you're an MSB member, and then you get like another 5% off if you happen to use Fold and a Fold gift card to make your purchases there. That's a pretty good way to stack discounts. Next up today, JM Bullion. You know, I am going to mention Bitcoin today. You know it's going to happen if we're talking about economic problems in this country. But I have never been the all of one, none of the other type of guy. I believe that there's a place for a physical asset and a place for a weightless asset that moves at the speed of light. They both have purposes. I put most of my surplus capital into Bitcoin, but I have not liquidated all of the capital that I've stacked into silver and gold, and you shouldn't either. And if you're not done with your stacking of silver and gold yet, and few of us are, you should be using the best provider you can find, especially if you're buying online. I get if you're buying from some local coin shop or something, but if you're buying online, then you should buy from a trusted provider who provides the best service and the lowest cost possible, because all silver and gold is the same, which is the whole point. So you should use JM Bullion because, one, I can talk to the president anytime I need to. Two, because they have great pricing, better than like Monex, Apex, and Lear Capital. Three, because everything ships free. And four, because if you're an MSB member, they give you a discount. The real question you should be asking, if you're buying silver and gold from anybody but JM Bullion, why are you doing that instead of buying from the company that sponsored the show that you listen to for more than a decade? All right, now let's kind of dig on into this. I want to kind of start off with why these five challenges that I'm going to bring to you right now matter. And to give you like the short thing, I'll just give you the top line items we're going to talk about today. Number one, national debt and deficit spending. Number two, inflation and monetary instability. Number three, deindustrialization and supply chain weakness. Number four, labor market imbalances. And number five, the housing affordability crisis, which is particularly both legitimately and mentally affecting millennials, younger millennials, and even some of the older Gen Zs at this point. And I'll explain what I mean by that when we get there. But why these five, and why are they mattering right now? Number one is because they're peaking at the same time. Like, these are all like peak issues right now. The national debt is higher than it's ever been. I guess that's always the case, but the problem that it's creating through things like $1 trillion just in interest payments from a country that has, you know, income taxes that net us about $3 to $4 trillion a year, and we have $1 trillion with it. Like, that is a peak of the problem. The national debt deficit spending also at a peak at a time when we cannot afford it. Inflation is actually quite moderated now, but its effects over time, because they're cumulative, have been just absolutely destructionist toward everything we're trying to achieve. And again, inflation, deindustrialization, the labor market, all of this stuff it's hitting its highest pain point, its highest pressure point. It's hitting its inflection. They're all hitting their inflection point kind of at the same time. Next, each weakens the average person's financial position. So if you are a super, super, super rich person, this stuff doesn't really mean that much to you. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. When I say super rich, I'm talking of somebody that measures their riches in how many tens of millions of dollars they have and above. So if you're worth $20, $30 million, you probably don't really care about this very much right now. When you have that kind of wealth, you're able to leverage it and always make more. Honestly, if you have a certain amount of money, you could pay yourself $500,000 for the rest of your life, leave your kids more than you started with almost no risk. So you don't care about this. If you're on the complete dole where you're living off government, you don't care as much as you might think you would, even though like smaller purchases that you buy with your SNAP card or whatever are higher. In the end, people that are completely living off the system, it's not as big a deal as it would be to a person who is working really hard, making decent to average money, and trying to get ahead. These all weaken that, and that's the vast majority of the country. For all of the class warfare they do with the super rich and the welfare mamas and all, the vast majority of the people in this country are working for a living and doing their best. And these all weaken that person. And the government response is, and I'm not even going to think of this bullshit where like, I hate the state is evil, the state is Satan, okay, fine, I can make a case for any of that. I'm going to say even when the best intentions are brought to bear on a problem, the responses from government have not fixed anything. In fact, the one person who maybe is making some things a little bit better is probably the most despised president we've ever had, and that is Trump. And you can say, well, a lot of people love him, a lot of people hate him, but I would say with total, like if there was a despisement quotient, like how despised is this person? and that's not supported or opposed, despised, then Trump is probably the most despised president we've ever had, particularly because he is actually trying, at least in some areas, to solve problems. And there's nothing that upsets the apple cart like making sure the person that runs the apple cart doesn't get everything that they want anymore. And that's really the pushback. Most of the people that hate Trump, I'm talking about general people, the people I'm talking about when I say that this affects everybody. Most of those people, if you ask them why they hate Trump, they don't have a good answer. They'll say something like, because I'm a woman and I don't have rights now. When you say, what rights do you not have now that you had 2 years ago? They don't have an answer. They get mad and they run away. They don't know what the answer is. So what that tells you is despite, right, the way this man is despised is a manufactured thing. It's not a pro or anti-Trump thing either. That's just reality. And it's because people don't, like, as bad as things are, when somebody tries to fix something and they go outside of what got us here, then they're hated. Because the reality is the average person doesn't understand any of this, so they do whatever they're told, and whichever side they've picked, they just hate the other side. And then all of the people that have adapted to it, the one thing that they do like is that they know what to expect. And if I know what to expect and I know how to make money off of this, I don't really care that it's bad for others. But if you start trying to fix it for others and I don't know what to expect and I don't know how to capitalize on it, now I'm very angry. And that's what you see going on here. And that's why this is all important. So let's start off with our number one problem. I do have these ranked, I think, in the order that is probably, you know, worst to least bad, I guess you'd say. But, you know, I have the housing problem at the end. So if you're 28 years old, you may hate me for that. But I'm talking about the macro, the overall movement of the country in the right direction. Because the other side is, if we solve that problem but not these other problems, those other problems don't get better because we solved it. But if we solve the first four, the fifth one will naturally begin to rectify itself. Maybe that'll make sense as I go. So starting off, let's start off with the U.S. national debt and deficit spending. And I'm not going to do a lot of pulling screens up today, but in this case, I wanted to because I think it really drives something home. Right now, we're over $36 trillion in debt. And the number is so large that the human mind can't really comprehend $36 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 million, and that's already something that's very hard to wrap your head around, right? I mean, I think people have a hard time with this, but I think one thing that people do understand is growth. And I don't know if you've ever been to the debtclock.org before, but at the top, there's a thing called time machine, and you can go forward and backward. Let's go backward in time. It just so happens that 2008 is an anchor point for the time machine. And I take that date because, one, it's there, and two, because that's when the show was launched. So the Survival Podcast has been around for as long as this data has been around. And in 2008, when people were freaking out about the national debt, the number was $10 trillion. $10 trillion. And if we, you know, go back to current day, then our $36 trillion. So the debt has grown by more than $26 trillion since the Survival Podcast became a thing. Now, when you say that, what people want to say is, but Trump grew it more than, or Obama grew it more than Bush, and Bush did it in 2008, and he screwed it up. But look, it doesn't matter who did it. It doesn't matter. If you get into tribalism here, you're not understanding the actual problem. This is because we have an economic system in the way that we create and manage our monetary supply that this is the result you would get. Now, maybe if some ass clown president before or had, you know, put a better chairman of the Fed in or something, maybe we'd be $34 trillion instead of $36 trillion in debt. Okay, does it really matter? At this point, it doesn't. We are now at a point where the interest payments are consuming more of an increasing share of the budget. Again, we're paying about $1 trillion in interest on the debt. In fact, here's our largest budget items we have right now. Medicare and Medicaid, $1.6 trillion, by and large, our biggest expense. And what is government trying to do right now? Cut Medicaid. Now, when people hear that, because they've been told to, they think that means push people off Medicaid, reduce Medicaid benefits. No, it means get the fraud out of the system. You saw how much fraud there was in USAID where we measured their payments in billions? How much do you think there is of fraud when we measure payments in trillions? There's massive fraud in that system. Social Security, $1.5 trillion. There's really no way to cut that. That's a third rail. That's not even a third rail. That's like a 15th rail in politics. You don't touch that. You don't touch that. Now, maybe we could squeeze out $50 billion of it that's fraud. Maybe $100 billion of it's fraud. Okay, so now you're down to $1.4 trillion. And these are non-discretionary, right? Defense and war, $900 million. We spent on defense and war $900 million. Let me remind you that over the past couple of years, we spent like another $300, $400 million paying for other people's wars in like Ukraine. Now, interest on the debt with those in mind, Medicare, $1.6 trillion, Social Security, $1.5, defense, $900 million, and call it $1 trillion because that's the big, beautiful bill that will eventually pass. Interest on the debt, $1 trillion. Like that right there is $5 trillion in spending. That's more than we take in. It's more than we're going to take in. You see why it's a problem? Because deficit spending is now routine. And how do they always... Did I say $1,000 million? I didn't mean to when I said how much a trillion was. See, that even messes with my head. 229 mix is 1,000 billion. Yeah, it's 1,000 billion. A billion's 1,000 million, and a trillion's 1,000 billion. I mean, really let it sink in how ridiculous these numbers are. They don't even make sense anymore. So that's all a problem from the federal level. But what about what is the problem with this at the state and localized level from an institutional standpoint, a government standpoint? Well, first of all, many state budgets are overly dependent on the federal aid in the first place. So if you cut the federal aid and you don't adjust the problem down at the state level, either the state runs a deficit or the state goes into bankruptcy or the state completely unravels and everybody in the state freaks out and blames the federal government for what the state failed to do right and what the state failed to prepare for. Makes fixing it difficult. Public pension liabilities strain local finances hugely. The biggest problem local governments have with their funding tends not to be keeping the lights on or keeping the existing workers working. There's been so much of an effective lobbying by government-level unions over the years, and so much of a concept of like the bureaucrat always wants to pay the other bureaucrat better because bureaucrats like to pay bureaucrats, that the retirement that some of these localized government entities like police and fire departments and teachers and just city and state and county workers have are excessive. Now, I know if you work for it, you're like, bullshit, that's my money. They promised it to me. I get that. I'm telling you, the promises should never have been made to the level that they're made because the money's not there. You can say you're underpaid, but if your employer goes bankrupt by paying you what you think you're worth, you'd be better off not being paid what you're worth. Right? I'll find a better employer. I suggest that you do that then if you work for a state or a city or a county that's doing this. Because eventually this all has to break. It cannot keep going. And then local government often will issue bonds for non-essential projects. Sometimes they just issue them. Sometimes they put them up for a vote. But when they put them up for a vote, the debate about the vote is never logical. We need this thing. It costs this much money, so we're willing to do a bond so that we can pay this much later to have this thing now. Does this make sense? No, it's, oh, that's welfare for the rich, or it's, we need it. And none of those are logical arguments. So this is all done with an emotional appeal. Now, what are the solutions? If we look at what federal and state governments can do combined, we come up with solutions like this. One would be, implement a balanced budget requirement for federal and state levels. I don't know if people, when they say they support that, understand what that means. That means 3 years, 2 to 3 years of recession, right out of the gate. And you have to stand through it to reap the benefit. If you do it for like a year and then you call all oxen free and you give up and you go back to what you were doing and start spending at a deficit again, it will make it all worse. Because the damage is done without the correction coming. So this has to be like a commitment. We're actually going to do this. And it requires either immense spending cuts or immense tax increases, or it requires increasing tax revenue without increasing tax rates by overall growth of the economy. Now, is that possible? Yeah. Do you think they're going to do it? Anybody that thinks they're going to do it, say, I think they'll do it. Put it in the, I bet not, nobody puts that in there. Then we would also need to audit and sunset ineffective programs against all tiers of government. If you said that to somebody back about February 15th this year, they're like, yeah, we're going to do it too. Look at Doge. Look at Elon. Look at Elon and his Adderall-fueled autistics. Go. They're sleeping there. They're working for free. They're funding all. And they found all the waste. And everybody went, oh God, look at how bad the waste is. The waste that they found cumulatively is about 1% of the federal budget. Anybody other than a lunatic looks at it and goes, yeah, that's waste. The left has gone nuts about it. Nobody in the general population gives a shit because the left goes nuts about everything. But, you know, nobody's actually cut anything. DOGE has not really cut anything. Maybe some administrative pulls here and there a little bit, but it's nothing meaningful. All the stuff that your congressman and senator got on TV and said, it's unbelievable what DOGE has found. Elon's done good. This is ridiculous. When they were asked to vote to actually cut that shit, they didn't do it. So that's the solution, but do you think they're going to do it? No one has said they think they're going to do it yet. And then you could shift focus to productive infrastructure that generates long-term economic returns. So what I mean by that is we need to be building the things that make business possible in this country. Some of that is physical infrastructure like roads and bridges. Other things would be rural internet to high speed, though that's not the holdback it used to be, really. We have still a lot of money being wasted on supposedly doing it, but, you know, hooking up Martha at the end of the 57th dirt road at the end of a road without a name in Kansas isn't really going to change the economy. If you actually wanted to make sure that everybody could be hooked up to rural internet, you just make it a hell of a lot. Like, you'd have these rural internet programs would just basically subsidize something like Starlink. That'll enrich Elon. Yeah, but it would work. But they don't care about it working. They care about grifting money. But that would be another thing. If we have good internet everywhere, and I know places that are in the middle of Jabip that there's good internet, so there's no excuse for it not to be there anyway. That would help some. But when I say productive infrastructure, it's everything, including regulatory environments that we'll get to later. It should be damn easy to start a business in this country. And I don't mean your local, your small business like mine, your solopreneur business. That's actually pretty easy to do. I mean, if you want to get a building and start manufacturing something, that should be super easy to do, but it's not. And that has a huge impact on our economic returns, because the more business you have, the more employed people you have, the more people making good money, the more people spending money, the higher your tax base would be without raising anybody's taxes. It's very simple to understand. If all the taxes stay exactly the way they are, and I'd actually like to see them cut, and if you did what I'm about to say and cut them, you'd probably actually get even more taxes. But if the economy grew by 20% and the taxes stayed the same, tax revenues will go up by 20%. And actually more, because they tax things every time they move one way or another. So you could have a 20% growth in the economy and about a 25 to 30% growth in tax receipts without raising anybody's taxes. Conversely, if you actually cut taxes and you do all this shit, you could explode the economy. You could, you know, double it in 5 years or more, or 5 years or less, I'm sorry. But they're not going to do it. So what can we do? Well, number one, what have I taught since day one? Eliminate or minimize your personal debt. Stop living on borrowed money. You might think because inflation eats away the value of money, it eats away the value of debt, you're fine in debt. If you're buying a house with debt, yeah. As long as it's well within what you can afford and you can manage, and if you lose your job for 2 months, you don't lose your house. Yeah, that debt leverage play pays. Okay. If you're buying consumer shit on a credit card, if you're traveling on your credit card, if you're doing any of that stuff where you're acquiring debt on things that are either used and done or depreciate in value, that debt is eating your very soul. And it's also the kind of debt that's not carrying a 6 or 7% interest rate. It's carrying a 22 or 26% interest rate. That's way worse than inflation. So you can't beat inflation with debt that has a higher interest rate than the rate of inflation. And when it has a 10X, you're effed. There's no way you win that war. So eliminate and minimize your debt. Acquire hard assets. This includes land, a house, tools, precious metals, Bitcoin, anything that you can say, this is going to serve me in value, is durable. It doesn't have to be 100% durable, right? Gold is durable. You can do whatever you want to gold. It's still gold in the end. You can melt it. You can beat it. You can pound it. You can bury it in the ground. You can take a dump on it. Like, it's, when you say durable, it's probably the most durable thing that the average person can put their hands on. However, something you invest in from a standpoint of a tool that will have a life expectancy of 10 years, if it makes you, let's say, $1,000 a year for 10 years and you net out $1,000 in income from it before it craps the bed and it cannot be repaired, or it's not worth repairing, there's a better model, but it costs you $1,500 out of the gate, that's a net positive. So when you look to acquiring assets, they need to be, yes, long-term appreciating assets, or short-term profit-returning assets. Or they need to be long-term assets that at some point will be not something you can sell, but if you had to buy it then, it would cost you a hell of a lot more. Tools and things like that fall into that category as well. Okay, and then you have to opt out of the federal dependency on some level. I talk about it all the time. We need parallel income streams. We need parallel systems. And I feel like in the end, we really need to make this happen some level of like a combination of like a swap meet and a farmer's market that's members only. You know, and I don't know exactly what that looks like, but you would think that Texas would be a great place for farmers markets. It's not. It is a serious pain in the ass to run a farmers market in Texas. We do not have much of a farmers market scene. It's kind of embarrassing if I travel to a state like California and go to one of their farmers markets versus ours. Like, we're supposed to be the free state, and California has much better, much more open, much easier ability for people to establish and participate in farmers markets. But it has to be more than that. But I don't want, you know, what I'm talking about, I don't think would be like your typical swap meet where people are just selling garbage and junk that you find in garage sales. I don't know exactly how that would be managed, and probably you need multiple models. But I think the way that you get around a lot of the local bullshit, because you're not going to have a lot of, you know, the federal department of making you sad for X is not the organization that shows up to shut down your farmers market. It's going to be your city, your county, or your state that does that. So by having a membership model, like, here's where this happens every week. No, you're not a member. You can't come in. Oh, you can't just buy a membership off the street. Somebody has to sponsor you in. I don't want to sponsor. Do you have somebody who wants to sponsor you in? No. Okay, bye-bye. You don't get to come in here. And then you need it so tightly run from a legal platform that if they did get in, there's nothing they can do anyway. Right? You don't need to be in, letting people in there selling meth or something like that. But we need to have kind of an above-ground, underground economy, if that makes sense, some way to keep the people that always screw things up out. Like, the government is why we can't have nice things. Right, so we need to have nice things by eliminating government from the equation wherever we can. But it can also be more simple things like, you know, people tell me how expensive meat is. Have you even looked for a local provider? Somebody that raises beef locally. If it's grass-fed and finished, great. If they grass-feed and they CAFO finish for 6 weeks, it's still better than what's in the grocery store for your local economy and for you and for your economy. Keep the money in the – so we should all have this mindset right now, okay? And this is not to the point of being stupid with, I only buy American even if I pay five times as much, all right? That's dumb. But the choice should be like, can I buy it from someone that I know? At the next level, no. Okay, can I buy it from someone who lives where I do, like in your city, your town, your county? No. Can I buy it from my state? No. Can I buy it from my country? No. Okay, then I'll buy it from outside the country. It's a basic counterbalance to economic entropy. One of the things Orange Man's trying to correct is that we have so much economic entropy and the U.S. dollars leave this country never to return. And really, all of his trade policy can be summed up as trying to bring America's dollars back to America. We put our energy into the creation of those dollars, and now other people are using our economic energy. It really is that simple, but the solution is not simple at all. Let's move on to inflation and monetary instability. So the debt is one problem. What about the inflation rate and the instability of our money across time? Federal policy struggles to balance inflation control and economic growth. In other words, we have taken something that is a market-driven thing and handed it over to central planners to override the market. And what I mean by that is if you simply had a single monetary instrument, if the free market worked like this, people should use whatever they want as money. You'd end up with one currency. Or maybe you'd end up with two. If we're still living in the world of gold and silver, where you'd have silver for smaller purchases because gold is so powerful and it's difficult to make really small pieces of either. But you'd have, like, it would be precious metals. Or it would be something like Bitcoin. Or some nation, if they got off their ass and did it right, could make a national currency that would have the clout or more of clout than the U.S. dollar does if they backed it and controlled it and regulated it right. And the regulation would be let the market set the cost. Let market discovery set the price. And the reason this is important, this is something very hard for people to understand. The market is what tells the companies what to build, who to hire, who to fire, what to develop, what to put research into. The market itself is the indicator. It is the only indicator that matters. In walks the Federal Reserve, which is just a form of monetary central planning. That's all that it is. And it says, we will make the dollar worth 2% less this year. And their attempt at doing that usually results in a dollar that's 4 to 6% less valuable. But everybody listens to them when they say it's 2%. Everybody designs to the 2% when it was actually a 6%, right? It's like running a campaign and not doing internal polls and actually believing the polls on CNN. Except it's far worse because it affects far more people. And now you've got people sitting in a room trying to dictate to the market what the market is, and the market's like, no, we're not. And then everybody's confused and everything eventually goes to shit. But if we did not have this manipulation, it's not like everything would be sunshine and roses, but we would have instant value discovery of products and services. People would actually, in the end, end up paying what something is worth for. Sometimes that would be more, and sometimes that would be less. But what it would be is accurate. And right now it's not accurate because you have a central planner trying to, it's like the weatherman saying the hurricane should land here because that's where I say it's going to land. It must follow my model because my model is more accurate than nature. That's what the Federal Reserve is. A weatherman trying to dictate when it rains, how much it rains, how fast the wind is. Like, instead of just trying to predict it and doing your best, trying to actually think you control it with your prediction. That's never going to work. That is absolutely never going to work. And they believe that it will. That's the bigger problem. Now, I want to say something about that, though, before I keep talking about the problem without acknowledging something. I think one of the best books you can read if you haven't yet or get it on audio and listen to is Laws of Life by Jack Spirico. No, I'm just kidding. One of the best books you could read if you haven't done so yet is the Fiat Standard by Saifedean Anomous. I can't say his friggin' last Anomous, I think is his last name. He tells a story in it at the beginning of how much he hates fiat, but then he talks about this parable. And the parable is something along the lines of there's a farmer finds a wall, and it's between his property and his neighbor's property. And it doesn't seem to do anything. It doesn't seem to be useful in any way. There's no problem with animals crossing back and forth. In fact, it's kind of in the way. And he wants to tear it down. And he asks the neighbor about it. And the neighbor says, yeah, I don't know what it does either. And he says, well, then I want to tear it down. And the neighbor says, no. Until you can tell me why it's there in the first place, I'm not going to let you tear it down. And so the fiat system as it is, as bad as it is, it existed to solve a problem. And this is an example of you can have the best of intentions, even if you don't, but you can try to at least have some good intentions and completely screw it up. Because the fiat system was designed to solve this fundamental problem. Remember, we didn't immediately go from gold to fiat overnight. There was a transitional period in between. And the problem was really they couldn't move gold and silver without a trusted third party across long distances and large volumes. It was all a ledger of account. You had to trust somebody to do it. And it made moving things like somebody buying 1,000 metric tons of grain or a ship or a fleet of airplanes from another country difficult, to say the least. But when they came up with the initial fiat standard, which was still tethered to precious metals, and telecommunicate the era came, it could be done very, very swiftly. And then all the other malevolent things that compounded on that, to at least some degree, were responses to the problems the first idea created. It's no different. You go to a doctor and the doctor says, I think you should take drug A. As bad as the pharmaceutical companies are, their marketing is and everything, I believe 99% of the time, that doctor really believes he made a good prescription. But then you start to have problems. So instead of saying, let's stop doing that, well, now take B to counter A. And you do that, and it counters the problem somewhat, but it creates a new problem. So now you're taking drug C. And the next thing you know, you're on 5 drugs, and it all started for one problem. And some of the problems you're taking drugs for now, you think are problems, but they're actually caused by this chain event of pharmaceuticals. That's the fiat system. That's the way that it is now. And so we need to understand that it's not evil just in of itself. It's just a system that is innately flawed, and anything you do to fix it will over time make it worse. Then you have national currency devaluation through money printing. Now, you might think that's the same as inflation, and it is, but inflation is the result. Money printing is the cause. Now, so the solution there is stop printing money, but do you think they're ever going to stop printing money? No. Okay. And then the other problem we have, because they are so sure of themselves and they're sending these signals to all the companies, and they're hiring, their research, their development, their marketing, their hiring practices and what have you. They say inflation is 2.1% right now. And then it's by the end of the year that they come back. Yeah, actually it was 3.1. Oops, sorry. And not 3.1 for the whole year, 3.1. Like quarter we told you about three quarters ago? Yeah, we were wrong by like three quarters of a point. Three quarters of a point is a big difference. So they have this lag in the data, and then they have this cocksure assurance that they're right about the data before the lag has enough time to come out and correct. How many times have jobs reports came out? They created an additional 350 million jobs. And then 3 weeks later, in fine print, it was actually 290 million jobs or whatever it was. This shit happens all the time. And it is this improper signal. And the improper signal is propagated by central planning of a market that cannot be central planned ever. It can't happen. At the state and local level, we have local utility and service. Right? That's the wrong one, isn't it? No, that's right. Okay. We have a lot of cost increases at the local level, and that's due to inflation, and it's impacting a lot of fixed income households. So one way to look at that is, in any state, a shitload of people in that state work for their state government, and they have a fairly fixed income rate in of themselves, even though they might get, you know, 2% annual raise or something like that. In the end, a lot of these local entities now are, and state entities are not doing rate, like they're locking rates or skipping a year of that or fighting the unions, depending on where you're at. But then you also have a tremendous number of people in that state that are on true fixed incomes, retirees, people on welfare, et cetera, and they all have a fixed income rate, and yet the expense keeps climbing. So this puts further stress, and the only solution the bureaucrat sees is give these people a raise, whether they work or not, give them more money, which then draws more against problem one, which is debt, both at the state and the federal level. Public employee contracts often do include automatic inflation raises, right? So all of a sudden you have people who have not gotten any better at their jobs, haven't gotten any more efficient at their jobs. All they were is at their jobs being paid, and they get paid more just because they're there. Now, if you are a city or state employee and you work really hard and you do your best, you might be getting pissed at me right now, but if you would, you know, take off your emotional bullshit coat for a second and look around at the people that you work with, you'd realize exactly what I'm saying is true. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, the maybe 5% of government employees that really do your best and really do work hard. Most of the people around you don't. And you know they don't. And the longer they're there, the less hard they work and the less output they tend to have, because the more they have of tenure and the more they have a guarantee and the more they have that if there is layoffs, it's not them. And maybe I'll have to go back to actually doing my job someday, but right now I have three lackeys underneath me to let do it while I drink coffee and wipe my ass all day long. Which this all just compounds again back into issue number one. And then another thing that we have a big problem with is a lot of times the state minimum wage laws are out of sync with the market, or local minimum wage laws are outside of the sync of the market. So this contracts economic activity in that less people get hired and less businesses are started. Look at what's happened in California since all of the bullshit they pulled with minimum wage. You know, it's not just fast food workers making $15 an hour, whatever the hell stupid number it is in California now. Like, the places that are closing are high-end, very well-known brand-name stores. And this is a combination of all these things, but it certainly has an impact when you tell somebody, you know, you have to pay somebody a minimum $18 an hour to do what? Clean toilets and sweep the floor? To sit on their ass for half the day when no one's in the store waiting for somebody to finally come in, dumb enough to buy a $300 pair of jeans that actually cost $5 to make? Like, I have to pay somebody that much money to do that? And that just caps growth, because what it also does is it delays entry into the workforce. When I was a kid, my first job, I think, minimum wage was, I want to say $3.35 an hour. I think my first job I had that was like a W-2 job was like $4. And I would have took it. I would have took it for $3.35. I would have took it for $2.50. I would have tried to get more, but I would have took whatever I could get, because I knew that I was young and broke and had, when I would go to talk to somebody about a job, they'd say, well, what experience do you have? Oh, no, I mow my grandma's lawn and take care of her garden. And I show up on time. Like, I don't have any, like, honest to God, this is my first job. I don't have any experience. Well, how do you get experience? You take a job. That's how you get experience. There should be, honest to God, there should be no minimum wage. And that might sound crazy to you, but I can prove it right now. I can prove it to you right now. If you remove service workers who get tips, who all make way more than minimum wage, by the way, if you remove that and you figure out how many full-time people in the United States are paid minimum wage, the answer is 3/4 of 1%. 3/4 of 1%. So if raising the minimum wage guarantees people to get paid better, why are less than 1% of people already paid minimum wage? Why is Chick-fil-A down the road here hiring people off the street with no experience and paying them $16 an hour? Why are those people at 3 months either fired or making $18 an hour? Because it's what the market demands. The whole thing that a minimum wage does is, again, it's another market disruption. People should be able to work for whatever they want to work for, and people should be able to pay whatever they want to pay, and then let the market work. But what we've done is we created this bullshit dynamic. We created these laws that say this person must be paid more money, even if they're not better at something. And what we've done with DEI, and I'm sorry I'm going to piss you guys off, but Women in the Workplace initiatives, which is just another form of DEI. If a woman is worth as much as a man as an employer, I will pay her as much as the man that she's working next to. The two highest paid employees I ever hired in my life were both women. I didn't do it because somebody told me to pay them better. They were both extremely qualified and very good, and that's how much I had to pay to get them to come work for me. And I won't say exactly how much, but both of them were over $200,000 a year. They didn't need a program to earn that kind of money. We have so many people who their jobs are not even necessary, making over six figures now. It's ridiculous. And yet the economy sucks, according to people. And the reason it sucks is because the money is not connected to actual value. It's just not. And the market has no say in the value of money at this point. It's so skewed, again, by central planning. what can we do about it? Well, promote local production and sourcing to reduce price volatility. So government policies that incentivize local economies, that's a great idea. That's what I would do if I had any control over anything, but I don't, and they're not going to do it. They actually love globalism. Globalism is their favorite thing in the world. Another thing that we could be doing at the government institutional level, encourage public budgeting practices that assume real-world inflation rates. In other words, let's stop believing Jerome Powell or anybody from the Fed that says inflation is 2.1%. At minimum, we should take whatever the Fed says inflation is, multiply it by 1.5. That's before you even do a sanity check on it. But we should be using a real-world metric feedback of actual inflation in our economic models. But we're not. They're not gonna. But if we did, maybe we'd have better central planning if we would at least do that. And then we should have programs that support personal savings incentives and real asset ownership. So this is an example of the government trying to help and fucking everything up. The entire concept of an FHA loan that goes all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt. Think about the fact that today you can save up 3% of the value of a home. That means a $200,000 home, $6,000. You can't get a home for $200,000, Jack. That's not even a thing anymore. The cheapest home where I live is you're a bullshitting liar unless you live in downtown San Francisco and then move. Okay? I'll get to that when we get to the last one today. But for a $200,000 house, which, yes, you can find, you can walk into a lending institution. You have decent credit, right, and a job and income and a reasonable ability to service the debt, which is all reasonable, with $6,000. And then you need about another $4,000 to cover most of your closing. And so $10,000, you can buy a $200,000 house and pay 30 years on it with an interest rate of like 6 to 7% right now. And a lot of you think that's terrible because you remember 3% interest rates and you don't realize how out of whack that was. So all of that's good and all of that encourages real home ownership. But what did the government eventually decide? Well, this program that incentivizes real asset ownership, it's not inclusive enough. We need to include people that can't afford it. We need to include people based on their racial characteristics, especially if they can't afford it and they're a race other than white. And so they opened up the lending ridiculously under Bush the second. And we ended up with then a crisis. And then a solution to the crisis was what? Government intervention in suppressing interest rates to 3%. And this is something I want you to take away from this. You know what I did when they suppressed interest rates? I refinanced or I bought property. So even though it was a bad move for them to do, I capitalized on it. You should not do something just because what they did was dumb if what you do is good for you. But this then accelerated the underlying value of houses because people don't buy houses based on a price anymore. They buy houses based on a payment. So when you suppress the payment, they went apeshit with the price of the property. I can get more for my property. And again, when I sold property during this time, I also sold it for more than I would have otherwise because I'm not dumb. I'm going to deal with the situation on the ground. But my point is they're not going to make it work. Whenever they do this, like what is another asset they've done this to? College education that is priceless, right? And a college education is worth less today than it's ever been worth in history, and it costs 5 times as much. That can't work in a market-based economy. That would never happen in a market-based economy. There is no way in the world that people would be paying what they are for degrees today if we were in a market-based economy that was based on the degree value. What can you do, though? Get out of fiat savings, at least in any long-term savings. Anything that you plan on holding for more than 3 or 4 years should be in Bitcoin, some form of growth-based or income-based equity, precious metals, property, something that is actually real, or a cash flow-generating business. That's where your money goes right now. You either need to be appreciating the value of the asset or generating yield off the asset. You need to be building food and energy resilience to offset your rising costs because those are the places that inflation is completely unhinged on. what happened in Texas was crazy after COVID. People's electric bills went up by like 1.75% without 1.75 without spending more money. 75% increase. In other words, if you typically had an electric bill of $100, it became $175. If you were running a business, this hurts even more because it affects how many people you can hire. Let's say you're running a business, a very large facility, $1,000 a month electric bill. That just went to $1,750. Now compound that over a year. Now you realize not only does that additional expense, it also reduces all that money could have been invested back into the business. So the more you can do for energy self-sufficiency, the better, not just from a prepper standpoint, but from an economic standpoint. And stop even paying attention to government CPI numbers. Because even if they were accurate, they don't mean anything to you. When they say the cost of food has gone up by 3%, 4%, 5%, 10%, doesn't matter. What's the cost of your food gone up by? How much do you grow yourself? I bet the food you grow yourself, the cost has gone up nothing. It's not free. Right? It requires your effort, but it also requires some level of input, and there's a cost of the input. But I bet that your food cost of food you produce did not go up. What is your food cost of beef that you buy from a local producer? How much has it gone up? Versus the supermarket's numbers. And sometimes your numbers will go up higher. You might eat a higher quality diet than what they base the CPI on, and I gotta hope you do. Right? What is your cost of housing done from an inflationary rate? If you bought a house a long time ago, it probably hasn't done that much other than property taxes. So you should be making your economic calculations off of your budget, not anything anybody else says. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're your best friend and they have an economics degree and they're not stupid. It still doesn't matter. It's not your household. It's not your income. It's not your expenses. Now, the next problem is deindustrialization and supply chain weakness. This one hits me different today than it did 15 years ago. And not because it's gotten worse, even though it has, because I've seen it. I've seen it. And I had kind of forgotten about it. I grew up in it in central Pennsylvania. There is no, well, I'm not going to say there's no place. There's few places that would be any worse off from a deindustrialization standpoint than the Northeast United States as a whole. All the way up into New England, out into Ohio and Indiana, all through that whole northeastern part of the United States, the amount of loss that occurred there. Big companies, too. Even some that are still in business and still have a presence there. You know, like Kodak would be an example. Just massive deindustrialization. And as you move into like Detroit and all, then you have the automotive deindustrialization. So I grew up seeing this. I grew up, you know, Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton. You can drive around and you can see steel mills. Where I grew up in Schuylkill County, you see defunct coal breakers, like, everywhere. But then I left, which was one of the best things I ever did for myself, was move here to Texas. And I got successful, and you kind of forget what you knew. And then after I started doing this podcast, and my business travel went from, you know, flying from city A to city B, only going to the nice parts of that city, negotiating contracts and deals, staying at a nice hotel, eating at a nice restaurant, flying home, and taking my wife out to a nice restaurant. My travel changed. And my travel became much more recreational or business-oriented, depending on what I was doing. But I did a lot more driving through small towns. And as I drove across this country, I came across town after town after town after town. And I guess in my head, because what I saw as a kid was when I was a kid, well, that was where I grew up that happened. And I'm sure it happened other places, but the sheer desolation of this country and small towns everywhere is really sad. And the problems on the federal level is national offshoring. It hollowed out our manufacturing capacity. Not only don't we build things here, but without massive reinvestment, we can't. You say we should buy stuff made in America. Where is it? How many things can I not get made in America today? And people fall back on this bullshit about, well, people don't want those jobs. Bullshit. Plenty of people want plenty of jobs. There's plenty of opportunity for people to do the work. And a lot of the work is not that hard. When I say manufacturing capacity, I'm not talking about a workforce. I'm talking about a place to make the thing and the ability to package and ship the thing and do so without a freaking wall of freaking regulations this high, because what you do might disturb the habitat of the striped-tailed foofy flu that lives 1,000 miles away from you and all the other crap that comes with it. So not only did we offshore all this manufacturing and all this service as well, we actually destroyed our ability to do it ourselves. We don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the facilities, and we don't have the regulatory environment. See, it's really easy to get a regulation passed that makes it hard to manufacture something when you're not manufacturing it here already, because you don't care. And so you can virtue signal that, hey, because of this, there's going to be more striped-tailed foofy flus around, and climate change will be less. But it doesn't mean it's real. And if it's the same amount of whatever you're calling pollution happening, but the pollution is happening over here, and you're talking about a global environmental issue, it doesn't really matter. Like, we offshored the pollution in the name of reducing pollution. It's just dumb. It's like when we ship our garbage to another country and they dump it in the ocean and we say that makes our place more clean. It's the same nonsense. It's a pattern that repeats over and over. But yes, this country has just been gutted. Places I've seen in Arkansas, Louisiana, and when you drive through these towns, you're like, there used to be something here. You know, and then you realize, like, it's only 15, 20, someplace, you know, 25, 30 years that this place was a thriving place with blue collar people, and it's gone. There's no reason it can't be again, but our current path, it won't be. We also depend on our adversarial nations for critical things, China being the most obvious. But see, China has a stigma to it now, either pro or anti, depending on who you are. So let's just not even worry about the name of the country. Just ask yourself this question. If you have a nation that you see at least as an economic adversary, a potential military adversary, and probably your biggest military adversary, or at least top five, should you rely on them to produce critical electronic components that you use for your defenses? Probably not. Should you rely on them to produce critical raw materials like steel and copper and aluminum that you use to build the things for your defense? Probably not. Should you rely on them to provide you the raw materials necessary to manufacture life-saving medications and antibiotics, especially if you might go to war and have higher need of them with that country that produced? See, all of these things, unless you are a complete sociopath, you say, no, you shouldn't do that. But it's exactly what we've done. So not only do we have less ability to produce for ourselves, we're actually reliant upon nations who do not like us for things that we critically require in our country to function, to save lives, and to defend ourselves. And then we have no national strategy for strategic industries. In fact, that's another thing that Orange Man is actually doing something about. I'm not saying it's perfect, but the man at least has a strategy. And yes, he has this madman way that he comes at things and makes people off balance. You know, that's all negotiation. When you look at the core, there's actually a strategy there. Is it a perfect strategy? No. Is it a good strategy? In some cases, I think it's very good. Some cases, I think it's excellent. And some cases, I think it's retarded. But at least there is a strategy. Who's had a strategy up till now? Don't you think that's part of why they're so pissed off? Because you know what upsets people? You've probably been through this at some level of your life. You're working in a place, especially if it's like in the military or government agency or something like that. And there's a lot of fucking off going on, right? And maybe you even don't like some of the fucking off that's going on, but you like the fucking off that you're doing and getting away with. And they promote somebody to department head, or like, you know, a new platoon sergeant comes in, depends on what agency you're in, even if it's just an office and they hire somebody, but they don't hire from inside. They hire somebody from outside and they come in and they say, wow, there's a lot of fucking off going around here. We're going to tighten this up. Doesn't everybody lose their shit? Even if they're like, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Behind the scenes, they're all pissed. They're all losing their shit. They all want it. They don't want it. They'd rather it stay the way that it is, even if they weren't happy with it. That's what's going on at the macro right now. Even the people that know this is wrong have adapted to it. They don't want it to change because then they'll have to readapt. You need to readapt now because it's going to change. There's no way to hold this the way that it is. But there's no national strategy. At the state level, state taxes and red tape deter industrial investment, just period. Like, there are states right now that it's a lot easier to do things, and it's still harder than it should be. Texas is an example. You know, Elon Musk recently said, if I had decided to build the Tesla Gigafactory in California, I wouldn't have broken ground yet, and it's been operational for a year and a half now in Texas. He's not exaggerating when he says that. He's a bullshitter. He exaggerates. He's not there. I guarantee you, if he tried to build the Gigafactory in California, he still would not have had the, you know, where they take the shovel and the ribbon, and it's a silver shovel, and they break the dirt, and everybody comes out and pretends that they're helping, but they're not. It's just a sandbox they put in. Like, that wouldn't even have happened yet. But yet, the state where it did happen, it's still too difficult to get things done. A lot of it's from federal regulation, but it's also local. And the problem with this is different states have different natural assets that companies want access to. Those natural assets include things like human resources. There's a lot of employers, they really do want to open their business in a place with a lot of good, high-level college graduates that are technically astute. That's a natural resource. I know we don't think of ourselves as natural resources, but we're natural. We're biological organisms, and they're native to the planet, so we're a natural resource, and our education is part of who we are. But there's also places that have, like, really great waterways. There's places that have really great climates. Sometimes climate's really important for the work that you're doing. You might think you don't want to be in a hot place, but some facilities actually do better in a hot, dry climate than a cool, humid climate, for example. And so we have this incredible resource in our diversity of our climate types, our states, our water resources, our agricultural resources, et cetera. And then we have this mixed bag of regulatory environment where you would think the states with lower regulations will automatically do better, but not if I need some of the other things. So the problem then is that the federal government can deregulate all that it wants and stop incentivizing this offshoring all they want. But if the local governments don't get on board with saying, hey, it's okay to make tires here, so we stop buying tires that are made in fucking Brazil, then you can't do it, right? If I can't build a facility to manufacture superconductors and chips because I can't get enough people to live there that have the education requirements to do it, and the place where the people are has a regulatory burden where I can't do it, then I can't do it. Then I don't care about tariffs. I can't do what I'm trying to do. I need to build X million chips a quarter, and I can't do it here. I can't do it there. I need this regulatory framework with this body count, or I need to pay enough to move these people here. And then those people say, I left because I couldn't get a job, and they come here, and they try to make the place just like the place that they destroyed through their voting action. This is one of, like, every pro has a con that balances it. The beauty of a republic is the competition. The con is the competition hurts itself, despite itself sometimes. And then we have local zoning. Like, the zoning alone, like, you can't build that there. Why? What environmental regulation? It's not zoned for it. Okay, well, nobody lives there. Does anybody that lives there have a problem? No, we just decided you can't do it. This is back to central planning. Instead of allowing people to buy property and then do what they want with it as long as they don't hurt their neighbor, we decided we're going to tell people what they can and can't do with different pieces of property. Now, a residential subdivision, I'll grant you, if I have a residential subdivision, I probably don't want Walmart walking in at the end and buying the last 50 lots and putting a mini Walmart right in the middle of the neighborhood. Okay, even I will give you that. Actually, I wouldn't stop it, but I can understand why you wouldn't want it. And I would say it's up to those people that live there to make that Walmart understand we're not going to buy from you if you do this. And we're going to make it very hard for you if you do this. So we don't want you here. Let the market, you know, solve its own problems. But okay, I get that one. But there are so many instances of this, you know, where people own large blocks of land and they can't do anything commercial with it because it's not zoned commercial. Why does that matter? because they want their tax money. And when you zone it commercial, they collect a higher tax rate on it. Wouldn't it be better to have, like, just think about it this way, if you're a greedy-ass local politician that thinks this way. Wouldn't it be better if there were just a lot more businesses doing a lot more business in the area that you govern so that they were generating a lot more economic activity so they would generate a lot more taxes into your tax base without you having to just rape people for owning dirt? But no, they'll never think this way. And then you have a lot of utility infrastructure gaps in rural areas that hinder factory development. Again, we have a lot of rural areas that don't have the electrical capacity, the telecommunications capacity to do things. If I'm going to put a data center in, which is one of the biggest growth sectors there is right now because of AI and many other things that they're not actually telling you about yet, but I'm going to put a data center in, what do I need? I need electricity that I can afford, and I need a lot of it. It's not just the rate. Can I get enough power? I think so many people out there, you don't understand how much energy it takes to run a garden variety data center. You know, something like the one that I designed for Broadcast.com before they sold to Yahoo. The amount of power that ran, I talk about a $1,000 electric bill. Try about 50,000 at the rates back then. 50,000 a month is what they were paying in power. How much power do you think that is? Okay. For a data center in 2000 or 1999. Yeah, it was 1999 I sold that data center. 1999, the estimated power draw on the bill, they said, was $50,000 a month to run it. Now, what do you think one costs today? We have much higher end, faster, higher power draw equipment. So I need power availability and cost. But I also need you to let me do it and not tell me I can't build it. Then I need very technical people. Then I need people that can build it just from a standpoint of construct it in the first place. Like one of the reasons we got that job, there's probably 20 cable installers available in the state that were even capable of managing and installing that job. So we were already one of 20 right there. Like everybody else wasn't, you know, two yucks in a truck weren't going to get that job. That wasn't doable. They couldn't finance it, let alone staff it. But once it's built, then I got to have people to come show up and work. I have to have people to sell and market. So I need a human resource there. And I need to be able to go on about my business long term without being afraid that the place I built it is going to change the regulations and cost me more money or shut me out and put me out of business. There's a huge problem there. And again, it's a much bigger issue that it's happening at the state and local level because there's not one place to fix it. It has to be fixed in every place that it's a problem. And that's not going to happen. So what can we do about that? Well, you can do tax and regulatory relief for domestic manufacturing startups. Trump's trying to do that, but it doesn't matter if Nebraska doesn't do it too, if you want business in Nebraska. Think of all the places where it would be great for new businesses to be built, from little concerns that would have like 25 people working to bigger ones with like 250 to 2,500 to huge ones like an Amazon warehouse employing a couple thousand people or more. But you can't do it. It's too expensive or it's just not doable. So I just don't see that happening at the state and local level. I think Trump's trying to do it at the federal. And that'll make the states that want it, that are willing to do carve-outs and exceptions, capable of attracting those businesses. And that's a good thing. You know, one thing they could do is modernize their zoning to support like a mixed-use environment. Why can't the average person have some sort of commercial operation out of their home if it's not causing problems for their neighbors? Like, I understand you don't want somebody to put an auto body shop with 20 people working on it in the middle of your neighborhood just for parking during business hours alone, plus where all the cars go. But there's a lot of businesses that are very capable of being commercial, advertised, and known. It could be like, you know, you have the front side of your house or the downstairs of a house, and it's a hair shop, a hair care shop, like someplace where you get your haircut. Like, you're going to have two or three people, four people maybe parking there at a time. If you have a big enough driveway, they're not even in the street. What's your problem? But that's very hard to do. And every little business spawns off other businesses because that person now has freedom to work for themselves. They have more money. They spend more money. That generates other businesses. But they're not working for larger employers. So there's a lot of ways we could modernize zoning, especially people that are like, they're zoned ag, but they can't do additional things. It's Joel Salatin wrote in one of his books, it is illegal for me to write and act as a writer on my farm because it's agricultural. Now, I don't think anybody really stops that, but that's just the level of absurdity that's there. Because it's zoned for one thing, I can't do another thing with it. It's ag, so it can't be commercial industrial at the same time. It doesn't make any sense. So I don't see them fixing that anytime soon. And I do think there's a real opportunity for especially the local governments and the state governments to start looking at developing something I would refer to, I guess, as a regional logistical hub, where they could actually start building business percolators, start actually creating environments that, or maybe even economic free zones. Like if you, like, here's how much we want to develop into this industrial park. And if you'll buy land here, then there'll be no taxes on the land for 15 years. You know, maybe there's state income tax. Maybe we don't charge any state corporate income tax for the first 5 years of your operation. Who knows? Or your first five profitable years, because often that manufacturing facilities isn't going to pay anything in income tax the first two, three, four, 5 years before they make a profit. So they could say, until you make your fifth year of profit, you don't pay any state income tax. This would attract people, right? And there's a lot of like federal, again, Trump's doing some of this stuff. Like Apple, repatriate your $80 billion from China, invest it here. We won't tax you to bring it back in. But what's Seattle going to do? What's Washington going to do? Right? Or wherever the hell they're at, you know? I don't see it. So what can individuals do? Support and source from local makers, producers, and repair shops. Again, back to, can you buy it from someone you know or someone that lives where you do? That's a very simple, easy step. And I'm not saying you're going to. I'm not saying you're going to. What I'm saying is, why don't you at least ask the question first? Can I get this from a local producer? If the answer is no, fine. But how many things do we buy willy-nilly without even asking? You know, sometimes you go into grocery stores even, they'll have like grown locally. At least shop there first. At least, you know, it's more expensive, but how much more? You know, let's say you don't grow your own tomatoes and it's a box of cherry tomatoes. And the cherry tomatoes that are just from California's greenhouses, I don't know, they're $2.99 for a little box of them. And the ones that are from Texas are $3.29. So they're 30 cents more. Is it going to change the temperature of the water in your pool? The expenditure won't, but if more people start doing it, again, economic entropy is a thing, meaning do dollars flow into or out of your country first, your state second, your county third, and your city fourth? But the most important one is the local one, the city level or the neighborhood level, or at least like the county level. That's the one you have the most control and impact over. And yes, you're going to buy things that come from outside your county. Why? Because they don't make everything you buy in your county. They don't grow coffee in Tarrant County, Texas. They're never going to. It don't make any sense. I accept that. My coffee, it comes from, you know, Sumatra or Colombia or Ethiopia or wherever. Right? A lot of it comes from the cold sauce. A lot of it comes from Brian up in Scrambling Brian. Some of it comes from the Mai Tai Coffee Company. But none of it comes from the U.S. as it's grown here. But maybe, you know, if you're not buying from one of our suppliers of our community, which is another form of non-entropy, is sticking within the TSP community. But even if you're going to stick to the home, maybe somebody roasts locally. Maybe you should find that person. Maybe you should buy your coffee from them or whatever you can. Learn trade skills, and we need to bring production back to the community level. There is no shortage of jobs for the skilled trade professional right now. You might have to move, but the more you do with what you have where you are, the less that will be the case. If you know how to actually do things right now, if you can work on cars, right, and not shade tree mechanic, you know how to change a starter motor. Like you actually know how to work on modern vehicles, you are not looking for a job unless you just decided you hate your boss and want a different one. Or you just want a raise and they won't give you enough and you're looking for one. It's not hard to find one. If you can weld, you can have a job right now. There's a lot of things that if you can do that, you can have a job, and pretty much anywhere in the world you can have a job, or anywhere in the country you can have a job. Now, you might need to move a county over. You might need to move closer to town for your commute. But some, you're not going to have to move across the country to get a job if you're a skilled professional in a trade right now. If there's people around you that need it, you can get a job doing it. Another thing is invest in tools and systems to let you produce more and consume less. So we talk about that all the time, so I'll leave it there. But the more you can produce for yourself, the less you're dependent on systems. Therefore, the less you're monetarily dependent on them as well. Labor market imbalances. What does this mean? There's just a huge national mismatch between job openings and worker skill sets. And it folds right into the last one, right? We have lots of opportunities for welders. We don't have that many good welders. We have lots of opportunities for mechanics. We don't have that many good mechanics. And this whole thing, we just need to let more immigrants in. Let all these immigrants in that have no skills is not going to fix that problem. Most immigrant labor comes in at very high levels or extremely low levels. The ones that come in at high levels tend not to be much of a problem, right? These are people that know how to do things from a technical or a professional standpoint that we just don't have enough people that know how to do it, period. We should have more. That would be another way to fix the problem, but we don't. But most of the immigrant labor that comes in is doing things that anybody could do, but a lot of people don't want to. Like anybody can mow a lawn. Now, people try that all the time, don't they? Like, well, if we don't have immigrants, who's going to mow your lawn? And most of us would say, me, because that's who mows it right now. The only time I ever paid somebody to mow my lawn was back when I used to travel all the time. And by the way, the dude that did it was a white dude from Schuylkill County, grew up in the same county I did, had moved out to Allentown and lived across the street from me. He ran a landscaping company and he had like three employees and they were all young people from the area and none of them were immigrants. So the one time I actually paid somebody to mow my lawn was so I wouldn't have to worry about it when I was on the road, you know, 28 days a month and my wife didn't have to worry about doing it. We had an acre. And it was very affordable even though there was no immigrant labor involved. But anybody can mow a lawn. Anybody can run a weed eater. Anybody can dig a ditch. You can drive around right now in Texas around here. They're doing a lot of underground work again like I did 25 years ago. Well, almost 30 years ago now. And I'll tell you, all the guys you see with a hard hat and a safety vest on actually busting ass digging a hole, almost all of them are Hispanic. And most of them are probably illegal labor. So we don't have enough people that are willing to do that work. So that's one imbalance. But one of the reasons we don't is we made it very comfortable to not work, which creates that imbalance. Because if you had a choice between you're going to be homeless or you go dig that hole over there where the foreman said to dig a hole, you're going to dig the hole. But if you have a choice to not dig the hole and not be homeless, you'll probably take that too. So we skewed it that way. But in the middle, there's all these jobs that require a certain level of training. People just don't have it. They don't have the education and the skill set. Our labor force participation is still below 2020 levels. So if you go pre-COVID, we had more people participating in the workforce than we do right now, even though we're almost at full employment, technically. That's a problem. Immigration policy does not prioritize the labor market's needs. In other words, the policy is all about just let them in. Let them in. They only want to work. Then why do we have to give them a phone, house them in hotels and schools that we kick legitimate people out of, and give them money and give them food if they're coming here to work? Because they're not. Because they do not have the skills that the market is actually saying we need. So if you're going to have people coming into the country, they should be filling a need, not your emotional desires. At the state level, states underfund trade schools and workforce retraining. Everybody goes to college is the whole mantra. So there's this entire space where people need education that's not catered to. It's not seen as a need. And it's the biggest need we currently have. We do not have a shortage of college degrees. Now, we definitely have a shortage of people with relevant college degrees to actually do something. The sheer number of people coming out with absolutely worthless degrees is obscene, and that could be tightened up too. But we're making no real investment. Now, some states are starting. Texas is doing some good, even at the high school level. right, where they are beginning to put in these VOTEC programs that are actually really, really good. But it's only in certain places. It's definitely not statewide. The other problem at the state level is local licensing requirements. They're just basically guilds. The person that already does the job doesn't want to remove the requirement, even if they know it's not necessary. And some states, again, Texas, I just know what Texas has done. So I'm not just saying, hey, Texas is right here. But Texas did this about 5 years ago, right before the pandemic started. They realized that they were requiring plumbers in new builds of housing to rough in pipe. And this is dumb. This is stupid. Roughing in pipe is not hard. And because they were doing that, it was elevating building costs. So they said, well, you know, as long as once everything's roughed in, that an inspector goes through and goes, yeah, it's all good, it doesn't matter who does it. So they eliminated the license requirement to do plumbing work on new construction. And, you know, the left went nuts. The left went nuts. Even a lot of the right went nuts, right? The middle right went nuts. Oh, my God, there's going to be flooding everywhere. The whole world, like, people are going to die because of this or something. You know what happened? Absolutely nothing. About a month after it passed, all the noise went away. Nobody talked about it ever again. Nothing happened. How many other places could we do that? But it isn't even the government so much as the government responding to the industry that says we don't want it. It's like my buddy down the road that runs a fireworks stand. Every couple of years, there comes a law in Texas that would make it much easier if you wanted to be a fireworks reseller to get a license to resell fireworks. Every couple of years, the law comes up. The biggest lobby against it are all the people that already have a permit. Why? Because it would be more competition and they don't want that. So you have the government, but you also have the industry and the guilds and the unions gilding people out with requirements that are nonsensical and don't really matter. And you know, if you want to do a lot of this stuff in these supposed authoritarian countries like China, you just go do it. And then public schools often fail to prepare students for high-demand local jobs. And I would say it's even worse than that. They don't just fail to prepare them. They actually tell them they don't want to do it. They'll say something like, you know, if you don't study hard and go to school, Johnny, and get a degree, you'll end up out there with a pick and a shovel. Maybe Johnny would be happy with a pick and a shovel. Maybe Johnny would go work with a pick and a shovel when he's 18 years old and doesn't know anything for, you know, low shit wage, because he doesn't need a lot of money because he's young and broke, and you're supposed to be broke when you're young. Maybe he would work for about 4 years, and by the time he was 4 years into it, he'd be running crews. Maybe he's heading for a project management position. Maybe he's getting other education to go along with his trade. Maybe he's but imagine how many people could have career progression like that that don't even consider it, because from the time they're freaking in kindergarten, they have a teacher telling them, you don't want to do that. That's bad. That actually matters. So what are the solutions? Expand apprenticeship and vocational training programs, which I think some of that is going to happen because the industry needs it so bad now they'll do it, and they will bribe the government where they have to be able to do it. Reform occupational licensing to lower barriers. All I can say is everywhere it has happened, it has been fought viciously with a massive propaganda campaign of lies to prevent it from going through. And then align educational funding with economic needs. What does that mean? That means when you say, I want to borrow, you know, $120,000 over 4 years to get a degree, that the lender would actually look at the degree and say, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but a degree in communications is not going to make you enough money getting out of school to even remotely service this debt. You don't have enough of an earnings potential to borrow this much money. Here's how much money we will loan you to get a communications degree. And then you'd have to go find a college where you can get a communications degree with that amount of money and decide if that's really what you want to do with your life. Right? Now, I got to tell you, I think the odds of that happening are much lower than upping the vocational, the VOTEC, the apprenticeship programs, all of those things, I think are more likely than that happening. The colleges are going to fight this until their back is broken. They're going to have a broken back. Trump's going to actually have to do what he said he was going to do, and now he's not talking about it anymore at all. What we need is a national college that anybody can attend online for free. We should have that. We should have that. And I don't think it'll be the best education you can get, but it'll be good enough for a base for the basic. And what it will do is drive down the cost. Or the college that's selling it for a high level will have to be selling more than their name. But if you graduate from Columbia, the world is open to you. There, I know there's people that have degrees from Columbia that work at Starbucks. So don't give me that. But you'd have to say, like, our program is better because. And this is the money our students make 5 years into their career. This is how many of them actually work in their degrees of study area, et cetera. There'd have to be actual competition. Because if you made a general, non-specific college degree open to anybody capable of doing it, you would devalue selling it to the point where you couldn't make any real money doing it. You'd have to do something more to earn the money and the lack of flexibility. If you give me the ability to pursue a degree online for little to no money, and I don't even care, let's say it happens to tuition, $1,000 a year. That's more than enough to run the website that runs the educational platform. It'd be a net positive to the government. It's a good deal. And you can even do it like a pay-go financing, right? You can pay $1,000 a year up front, or you pay $100 a month. If you all pay $100 a month for something, you don't want it. Interesting, huh? How easy would that be to do, too? And, like, you don't need 10,000 degrees, like 50 fields of study, generalized degrees, you know, and maybe some of them are preparatory that, like, your last 2 years of degrees, you're going to need a facility that has a lab. So you can take your associate degree from this program and go apply to transfer into it. They won't accept you. They will when it's all they have because they already have an enrollment cliff hitting them right the fuck now between the eyes. But that's why they won't give an inch until their back has to be broken. It has to be brutally broken. The educational institution, higher learning, university level education system needs to be broken like breaking the back of a union. In fact, it's harder. They're more ingrained. They're more entrenched. They have more power. They have more control. But they have to be destroyed to be rebuilt. They cannot be rehabilitated because they're all scrambling now for whatever's left because the total number of students enrolling is going down. Not because less kids want to go to college as a percentage of graduates, because less kids are graduating high school. Not because less kids are getting through high school, because less kids are starting high school because people are having less babies. That's why the globalists want so much immigration. They want to backfill the number of kids we're not having. Hillary Clinton just said it live in an interview. The truth came out. Every once in a while it does. Whoops, I said the quiet part out loud. We don't need to worry about Americans having babies. That's what immigrants are for. That's paraphrasing, but it's literally what she said. And I mean like 2 days ago, not like 20 years ago we dug some shit up. Like that just happened. This is how these people think. We can backfill it. What can you do though? Learn high-value, low-credential skills that are in demand. There's a lot of things you can learn how to do that have no credential requirement whatsoever, and all the person that hires you wants to know, whether it's an individual or a company, is can you do it? And when it's a skill, it's a hard skill that you can demonstrate you can do, then your job interview should be, here, I made this. If you don't believe I made this, I'll make one in front of you. Here, this is my welding. This is your shop. Move. What do you need to put together and what kind of weld do you want on it? Hoods up. Is that good enough? Yes or no? Because I got another place to go interview with. I'm looking for a job now. Like, there's a lot of stuff like that. And there's a lot of stuff that has credentials, but they're pretty low-hanging credentials. Some sort of tech certification you can get in a couple, 3 months for a couple $1,000. And maybe you don't even really need it to do the job, but you need it to get the job. Those are the things to be targeting right now. Create your own job through freelance, trade work, local service business. Start your own business. You know, I know I'm going to be dropping this ChatGPT course soon. It's going to be a great course. But if you don't know what business to start, start off with a discussion with AI on that. Here's who I am. Here's what I know. Here's what I like. Here's what I hate. Here's what I want to do. Here's what I don't want to do. Here's where I live. I mean, it probably will be able to find out a lot about the demographics of your area to begin with really, really quick. Help me spot opportunities. Start coming up with an idea. Like, I know I always say ideas are useless, but let me explain what I mean about ideas being useless. Ideas that do not result in driving actions are useless. So instead of, I got this idea for a business. I got this idea for a product. Are you doing it? No, then it's useless. If you're developing the idea so that you can develop the business, it's useful as long as at some point you make the transition. I just did a show on it last week, and it's the truth. There is no thing in this world that will grant you more freedom to yourself than the ownership of a business that produces beyond your needs. Once you have that, you have all your needs taken care of from your business. Then it's only a matter of growing it to meet your wants and then exceed your wants, and then the surplus is your wealth. Simple. And it's not as hard as you've been led to believe. And yes, you can do it. And every second you spend telling me or yourself in your head that you can't is 1 second of your dash gone forever that you'll never get back, that you've wasted on bullshit because somebody told you you couldn't and you believe them, even if that somebody was yourself. That's the number one thing you can do. And stop waiting for career tracks. Like, there's people like, oh, I want to do this or I want to do that. Great. And if you get the opportunity to do that, that's fine. But right now, do what pays money. There's a lot of shit I did in my life. I'm glad I did. Some of it I wish I didn't have to. All of it led me to where I am, though. And there was a time when I was like, you know, do you think when I was 16 years old and I was in high school, I wanted to clean the kill floor of a turkey farm? Do you think I was like, that's a career? No, but you know what I thought? Look at all these losers that I'm in school with, and none of them will do it. And they pay like more money than a lot of grown-ass men make working full-time jobs for seasonal work because nobody wants to do it. So I can have that money if I go do it. Plus, it'll be now I'll have some of that experience they're always telling me I need when I apply for jobs. So I went and did it for a few months. And the only reason it was a few months is that's how long the job lasted. Now, they actually offered me a full-time job at the end of that, and I'm like, I would have to drop out of school. And they were like, okay. No. But I mean, that quickly, if I wanted to, I could have had, and there were a lot of grown-ass men that worked at that place. Because you went and did it. So if there's something that pays the bills now, by all means do it. Instead of waiting for the thing that is directly in your career path. But while you're doing it, look for the thing in your career path. You'll find it faster. You'll be motivated. You won't make as many excuses. And you'll be motivated. It's a motivation sandwich. You'll be motivated because you'll want something better, right? You won't make excuses because you're too busy working. And you'll be motivated because you'll start to hate what you're doing because it's not really what you want to do. So every day you go to work, you'll be more motivated to look for the thing you really want because you don't want to be where you are. Or you'll find a way to make that path work and make it into something you want. Either way, you win. The last one, the housing affordability crisis. And this is real, but I have mixed feelings on this. And I get a lot of pushback when I push back on this whole bullshit about I'll never own a house. It was easy for boomers in 1985. Yeah, it was easy for boomers in 1985 with a 12.9% interest rate. Really? It was? And by the way, are you buying the house that they bought? Are you buying the 3-bedroom, 1-bath house? Is that what you're buying? Are you buying like the modern, like 10, 15-year-old McMansion that you think you need because it's what your parents had? I know not everybody's doing that, but a hell of a lot of you are. I do think we come down on young people too much with, if you can't afford a house and you're eating avocado toast from Starbucks, you're wrong. Here's the thing. What they'll say is, if I stop eating avocado toast from Starbucks, I still can't afford a house. And they are right. If that is the only change that they make, they can't buy a house. But they still should make that change because that is a true luxury. And by the way, you could make your own avocado toast at home for about 1/5 of the cost. And you can make your coffee for about 1/10 of the cost, and both of them can be better. So you don't actually have to give anything up except standing in line at Starbucks because I don't know why you like that, but you do. And but when we typecast these young people that way, we're not helping them. Because that's all they hear from Gen Xers and boomers, right? That's all they think that we think that if you just did that, you'd know. There's a lot of things, but that's the extreme, and that's why it gets pointed out. But here's our problems and why we have this problem in the first place. Federal incentives boost demand without increasing supply. So the government, like I said, especially under Bush the second, but this really began under Reagan, did everything it could to broaden the FHA loan programs and to broaden other programs so you could afford to buy a house. It did almost nothing to increase the housing supply. Here's the thing. if you incentivize building and construction of housing, if you loosen up the regulations, so there's just more houses, prices will go down. That's how it works, supply and demand. Increase the supply, you will reduce the demand curve. And you wouldn't have to subsidize everything, which only increases demand and does nothing for supply. Okay? Mortgage policies inflate prices through subsidized credit. In other words, when we had 3% interest rates and everybody thought that was great, that's why you're looking at a house right now going, how is this house $400,000? That's how it got there. And the guy is holding strong on his price because he wants what he put into it. And when people stop getting what they put into it, what do we have? We have a real estate crash. Nobody wants that. But I'm going to tell you, we need a big, fat, effing real estate crash to fix this problem because the properties are overvalued. The only way you can fix this problem right now without a crash, you have to have some level of pullback, some expansion of the supply, and a flat real estate market for about 10 years to let things rebalance. And then it won't even be fixed. It just won't hurt so bad. But if we don't increase the supply, we're not going to get anywhere. We have more people, you got to have more houses. Would you just say the population is in decline? Not yet. We still have a lot, like, because people are living longer and older, there's still a lot more people than there were 20 years ago. And then we had this massive amount of inflation immigration over 20 years. We brought all these people. This is another thing, man. We brought all these people in. Let's not even debate whether they should have been allowed in or not. When we let, under Biden, over 4 years, over 20 million people into this country, and that's the real number, it's about 20 million people, how many more power plants did we build? Almost none. You think 20 million people might need some power? Did we build enough housing? Even if you divide it by four and say it's 5 million people, a family's of four on average, which it isn't, but let's just say it is, to house 5 million new households? No. That's a problem. You see how that works? See, these things are so simple to understand, but they're difficult to fix. And this is a big part of the mortgage policies and making it easier to buy a house, but not making it easier to build houses or produce houses. Why do, and we'll get to the local people too, but if you right now wanted to really solve this problem, you would make it so easy for someone to say, I'm doing a tiny house development. And it's not even tiny, small. We're going to put in a bunch of houses. They're all going to be about 700 square foot. There's going to be three different floor plans. Pick your colors. And it's going to be cheap. And they are marketed as starter homes. They're all one bedroom. Maybe you got a bedroom. You got like a little area that could be a second bedroom for like a single, you know, a family with one child. Or it would make a good office for somebody like me. You sell the hell out of them. That would get people in at an entry-level house. They would build up equity, and they could do that in their 20s. And that meant by the time they're like 30 to 35, they would be able to move into a more typical single-family home. Right now, apartments are serving that capacity, but that's gotten ridiculous where people are paying more to rent a one-bedroom than they can buy a three-bedroom, but they can't qualify for the mortgage on the three-bedroom, even though they're already paying more than the mortgage on the one-bedroom apartment. This, again, it's all gilding. It's all, you think the people that run the apartment complexes of the world, the giant property management companies that tend to own properties with 100 to 500 units, do you think they want what I just said? And who do you think has more money to lobby the government? People that want to build houses or people that already manage multi-tenant housing? And the government's very responsive to lobbying, more than voting, way more than voting. And national building standards add a lot of cost and complexity. But the national standards are nothing compared to the local and state standards. Zoning laws restrict multifamily and affordable housing, right? And if you want to build an apartment complex for low-income people with government subsidy, a lot of these places just let you go nuts. But if you want to build something really nice without going completely upscale, that's what's hard. The middle income property is hard. Right now, I bet you if you're renting and you are, you know, making $50,000 to $80,000 a year, which is a good income, whether it's individually or as a couple, and you're renting an apartment in an apartment complex, you're probably living in an apartment that was built at least 25 to 30 years ago or older. How do I know that? Because I know what it costs to build one today. And I know you make too much money to live in the really super nice ones that are only for people that don't make enough money. And you know how most people that live in those apartments, they lie about how much money they make. You know, they have a couple, and the wife works part-time somewhere, but she's not a wife, she's a girlfriend. And the guy's not married to her, and she has a kid, and might even be his kid. He pays child support, but he's not there as a tenant. And she goes in and applies for the apartment, and she puts down just her income. And maybe if it's a little too much, she just takes a little bit off and underreports it, and they let her move in. And then dude moves in, and then that's what's going on there all the time. Do you think those people want to do that? No, they feel like this is the only way we can make things work. That's how a lot of this stuff works, which makes weaker family units because people defer marriage so that they can play that game and a lot of other games like Medicaid, et cetera. And this is the results of it. Permit backlogs in some states are ridiculous. You know, when Trump went to California and kind of beat up on the people there after the fires, Newsom and I can't think of her name, the mayor of L.A. and all these people. Yeah, we're going to expedite. Yeah, we're going to do it. Yeah. They haven't done shit. Oh, but what about a free state like Florida? Hey, I just talked to a guy that went through Hurricane Helene in Florida on the Gulf Coast. There's still thousands of houses not even started on rebuilding because they can't, because of friggin' red tape and bullshit at the local level, not the federal level. And there's just a lot of things that block development in areas that allow more people to move into them, because we're just not building enough houses. So what are the solutions? Number one, reform zoning and allow for more properties to be developed and more houses to be built and a little bit higher population density where it makes sense. Not going to happen. Because every, especially the boomers who are going to die in their house, and there's no good reason for this mindset, we have to protect our property values. Why? So you can pay higher taxes on it? Realize how ridiculous that sounds? Like, these people are going to, like, stay in their home till they die, and they're worried about the property value. Once I stop moving, I don't give a – I would be happy right now if Tarrant County said, Jack, we've evaluated your property. You know, the economy's just not very good. We think your property's only worth $100,000. And if it was true, and that's all I could sell for, I still wouldn't give a shit. I still wouldn't care. I have no plans to go anywhere. The longer you're in a place, the less you're concerned about the property's value and the value of the property to you. That's what you start caring. What is it worth to me? Not what is it worth to somebody else if I sell it. But everybody's leveraged with home equity loans and shit like that on top of it. Everybody wants to step up and buy a bigger house, another house, et cetera. And we're not doing anything to create that entry-level home. Another thing we could do, fast-track permitting at the local level. They're not going to do it. We should fast track everything too. We should make it easier for housing alternatives to come into place. We should make it easy for people to build things like earth contact structures. We should change laws to make it easier for people to build things like monolithic dome homes. I mean, they last forever, durable. If you're going to increase supply, the other side you got to look at when you're increasing supply is how durable is what you're putting in place. Right now, we build houses that sell brand new for $500,000. If you walk through them during the construction phase and you know anything about construction, you're like, this is abysmal. There's a guy I follow on X. I can't think of his name now. All he does is post pictures of houses and go, this is $500,000 new build. And you're looking up through the roof before the roofing goes on. You can see through it. You see nail pops everywhere. You see joints that look like some retarded monkey put them together. I mean, it's abysmal, the quality of construction, and all these homes start to completely fall apart in about 20 years. And we build them all at the same time in a subdivision, so they all fall apart right at the same time. So we should be looking at, if we're going to be making housing more affordable, we either need to make it something that when its end of life cycle comes, it can be repurposed, or we need to make it durable so it stays part of the supply. But we're doing neither one. And I don't see any of that happening anytime soon. And I think that there should be some sort of way that we could make it painful for states, directly painful, to preempt the growth of local population. In other words, they do things to purposely hold back building more housing. That should hurt, right? And I can sum that up with, and I've said this forever, stupid should hurt. If we had stupid equal pain for the person that is being stupid, not the people around them, then we'd have less stupid. Well, being a state and saying you want growth and then turning around and saying, but we don't want that growth over there, that's stupid. And it should be painful in some way. I don't know how. And I don't see that happening. So what can you do? Well, you can consider alternative living models, tiny homes, homesteads, shared land, compounds. Those are all options. You can just work really hard and save enough money to actually be able to buy a place in a way that makes sense for you. You can be smart about where you live and how you live. That would be helpful. You can also build equity through unconventional routes, like rehabbing properties, so that you, or even flipping raw land. Like, let's say you go the RV route. First thing you do to improve a property is you bring power to it. Now your RV can set up. Maybe you put in a place for your RV that's nice and comfortable, and then you work on the land. And when you get the land to a point where it's a really good site to build, you flip the land and go do it again. And you do that enough times, you develop enough of a track record and credit and income and money and capital reserve that you can go buy a piece of property. Or you might find that you actually like doing it that way, or you might actually take that approach and then slowly build your own home. Well, Jack, what about all this bullshit you said about regulations? Pick the right place. Be smart about where you go. Hedge against housing inflation. One of the ways to do that is stop holding cash, dollars. Like, if you're holding dollars on long-term income rate or long-term money right now, you're just throwing money away. I mean, you're literally having your savings eroded from underneath. You're stacking cash, right? Let's say you're stacking dollars, right? And you stack, you know, $100,000 in cash. So you have $100,000 in cash reserves. You're losing $4,000 to $8,000 a year in actual purchasing power. So it's like you keep throwing money on the top and somebody just keeps pulling it off the bottom. And you're wondering why the stack's bigger, but it's not. It's higher, but it doesn't buy more. That's why. So that would be things, you know, I'm going to say Bitcoin would be one thing. Actually getting into some form of property that you own smartly would be another. Other inflation-resistant assets. And people hate it when I tell them this when they're young. Take a second job. Here's why you take a second job when you're young. One, you can. You have the physical stamina and capability to do it. But two, if you're working a job right now and you're paying all your bills, even if you're ending up with almost nothing left, right, but you are able to afford all your bills on one job, how much of your second income can you save? The answer would be all of it. That takes discipline and it takes long-term thinking. But you can save up a lot of money in 3 to 5 years that way. 3 to 5 years. Yes. Yes. When I tell people say to me, well, how old were you when you bought your first house? 26. 26. Well, it must be nice. Well, you'll never have one. That's what it must be nice. That's poison to your future. But what they don't know is that I was working at least two jobs almost the entire time between when I got out of the Army and came here at, I was 20, just 21 years old till I was 26 and bought a house. It was almost the entire period that I had part-time gigs, second gigs, etc. That's how I did it. Now, here's the other thing that happens when you take a second job. All the stuff you do to waste your money, you don't have time to do anymore. I've had this discussion with people on social media, and you hear these young people, well, it's just great. I'll never see my friends. I'll never have any fun. Well, never's a big word, little man. It really is. Never's an awful big word. It's not never. It is less. You will see your friends less. Many of them who are often broke like you and reinforcing your bullshit in your head with how broke you are and how you're not going to get anywhere and how it's somebody else's fault. So that's not good. That's one thing. But your fun usually involves spending money, right? And so you'll spend less money, and then you'll have I'm not going to tell y'all what Jim just – or Mick said. That's pretty funny. Yeah. That is – I'll tell you, the Eeyore voice. It is the Eeyore voice, right? I'll never have any fun. I'll never see my friends. Yeah, you make new – Jim says you make new friends at work. You don't got a friend you make at work? People that are at least a little bit productive, especially second jobs. Second jobs tend to have people who are working second jobs, so they're motivated like you. You make more friends. You make more contacts. You find more opportunities. Hey, I've hired people at bars, and they usually weren't the people drinking. You know, I've hired people that were working at bars. You know why? It's Friday night. It's 9 o'clock. You could be on my side of the bar, but you're on that side of the bar. You're working. You're hustling. I've hired people at restaurants waiting on tables. Look at the person just working their ass off, and they end up being your server. You're like, hey, you've been here a long time? Yeah. Do you like it? Yeah. Do you work all the time? I work part-time. I'm doing this or whatever. Really? We've hired people like that. I have, partners have, because motivation is way more. I can teach you anything you need to know to do most jobs. And we're not talking about hiring somebody to be a neurosurgeon, right? Or a high-level computer programmer or something. Most jobs, what you need to know is not that hard to learn. Most jobs can be taught to a person who's never seen it before if they have an IQ of 100 or greater and they're motivated in 2 weeks. But you know what you can't teach in 2 weeks? How to make an unmotivated motherfucker motivated. That I cannot give you. Knowledge, and I can give you most jobs I've ever hired people into. We literally had an employee handbook that was 90% of what you needed to know. Here, do this shit and you won't get fired. But no. So there's a lot of opportunity here, guys. I didn't want today's show to be a downer. But what it means to you going forward is pretty simple. Number one, you can't wait for top-down fixes. The reason we went through a show that ended up this long to go through all these things the government could do to fix it was because I knew that, you know, about 6 bullet points each problem, 3 federal, 3 local, that you would go, they're not going to fix that. They're not. I wanted you to think that way because you can't wait for it to be fixed. Anything that gets better, if you're in motion, gets a magnified level of better for you. In other words, yes, a rising tide floats all boats, but if you get your boat out of the harbor, you can follow the tide out to sea while everybody else is just getting detached from the freaking dock. Local and personal action will beat national promises every time. Think about the fact that we have had roaring economies and a shitload of people that did terrible in them. And we have had terrible economies and a shitload of people that did well in them. That tells you right there that the economy in of itself is not the end all be all. Yes, things get easier when the economy's better, but easier is like a factor, right? So if it gets two times easier, and you're extending an effort of 2, that's a 4. If you're extending an effort of 0 and it gets 2 times easier, that's a result of a 0. If you're extending an effort as a 1 and it gets 2 times easier, that's a result of a 2. Right? It's pretty simple. And if you're extending an effort of a 5 and it gets 2 times easier, it's a 10. And there's no way around that. There's no way that you can ever change that reality. That's why at times when I am told that I was lucky you were around back then because things were really great, you don't know you weren't here. You were still shitting your pants or weren't born yet. And it wasn't as easy as you think. Nostalgia is blind, man. Nostalgia is not even looking through rose-colored glasses. It's through dog-shit-colored glasses. Like, especially a nostalgia for a time you never existed in. You know, I always try to be careful of that, not thinking life was so great in the 50s and 60s. I knew I wasn't even born yet. It might have been better than the 90s when I was coming up, but how much better? I don't know. I know that people were dead broke in the 60s, they were dead broke in the 50s, they were dead broke in the 40s, they were dead broke in the 70s, they were dead broke in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. I know people that did very well in all those times as well. The individual action is what's most important. Build resilience now. It's the only real hedge. You are your own hedge. You are your only real hedge. If you had everything I have right now, you were my age, my relative level of health, you owned a home similar to mine, you had the same amount of investments in Bitcoin that I do, and et cetera, you'd probably be okay for the rest of your life. Probably. I don't know, you could screw it up. But sooner or later, something will come along and require adjustment. And if I make a better adjustment than you, even if we start in the same place this late in the game, I'll still leap ahead of you. Think about how many I've adjusted this show. We've been doing the show 17 years next month. We're 1 month away today from our 17th birthday. So 17 years I've been doing this show. I've made significant major adaptations and adjustments to the show, its revenue model over the year, because it's not static. What do I always say? Right? Preparedness, self-sufficiency, lifestyle, none of it's static. It's a sliding scale. You increase it or life pushes you backwards. So you have to think that way. I am my own hedge. You know, is Bitcoin a hedge against financial inflation? Yes. But who buys the Bitcoin? Who doesn't sell the Bitcoin just because it went up? Who doesn't sell it just because it went down? Who keeps buying it while it's going down? Who keeps buying it while it's going up? You. You're the actual hedge. Is spending less of your money a hedge by having more capital reserve? Yes, but who has to do it? You. Is buying an option against the stock that you owned, a covered call or a covered put, as an insurance of it taking a radical move in one direction, is that a hedge? That's actually the very definition of a hedge in stock trading. Even a collar trade where you put a put and a call option on both sides of it. About the only way you lose then is it doesn't go anywhere. As long as it goes somewhere, you make money, right? Well, is that a hedge? Yes. There's whole books on hedging stocks that tell you how to do shit like that. So that's a hedge. But who does it? You. You know what's a hedge on the economy? Having five skills that are marketable beyond what you do for your profession. You know, if you know how to frame houses, you can probably find a job somewhere. And if you can't find a job framing houses, you can probably find a job repairing roofs. And if you can't do that, you can probably find a job welding. Now, those are all significant workman blue-collar trades. And maybe they all shouldn't be that. If you're a good marketer and your business tanks because the whole sector dumps, you still have a marketing potential for other people. You see what I'm saying? Like, the more you know how to do, the more adaptable you are and the bigger a hedge you are in your own life. You must become your own hedge. And I don't mean the kind that we plant. I mean the kind that we actually grow. We have to grow ourselves as a hedge, not plant ourselves as a hedge. Real quick, if you want to know more about how to do all of these things, then consider, if you have not already done so, picking up my book, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. We have done really well with this book. Over the past week, we sold well into the thousands of copies, thanks to you guys. Many of you have bought them for yourself and for your friends and family. I would like to now at this time say there's enough of them out there. We've read enough. Please consider doing a review for me. I've also had some people feedback on typesetting issues. I know. I have somebody I'm working on fixing that with. It was either get the damn book out or keep delaying it. And I practice what I preach, get the book out. There's a typo in it. I honestly don't give a shit. I mean, as we fix the typesetting, we'll try to fix that where and as we can. But I think I wrote in the book, somewhere in the book. I'm pretty sure if you read the whole book, there'll be a part about, I'm sure there'll be some typos. And when you see somebody complain about it, point out this part where I said it's less important than taking the content of the book for what it is. Lion's Den says the first four chapters are phenomenal, still cracking at it. Thanks for reading it, man. And I would also say, like, a lot of you guys are doing things for me, like posting pictures of the book, Joel Riles posted a picture of one of his dogs. Somebody did it with their kids saying, I'm going to make sure all the kids get a copy. Guys, I can't tell you how much that helps me. It really does. I've never actually had people get behind me this hard on something before. So if you can do stuff like that, that would be great. I don't care if you have 50 people that follow you on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. It still matters. It still helps. And if I see it, I'm going to share it. Every time I see one, I'm like, share, 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 share. So help me help you help me, right? But do consider getting a copy of the book. That's all I got for you guys today. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode. We'll try to go to something that's more like a homestead topic or something like that tomorrow. It's been a while since we did that. But this is just where my head is right now, so that's what I've been doing. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. Revolution.